Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for November 12, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, literacy's effects on brain function, what U.S. election results mean for science, and how a wandering mind appears also to be an unhappy one. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how whales get sunburns too, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Whether cuneiform of Sumerians, hieroglyphs of Egyptians, or any other ancient language, our ability to read and write is a cultural invention, and so on a completely different timescale from the evolution of the human brain. And that means that whatever parts of our brains are involved in literacy, they didn't evolve to do so. In other words, there was no selective pressure to read and write that allowed more literate people to survive. But do people benefit in brain function as a result of learning to read, or suffer because literacy function competes with evolutionarily older functions, such as perceiving other people's faces? In a paper published online by Science, Stanislas Dehaene and colleagues ask that question and report how learning to read changes the brain's networks for vision and language. I spoke with Dehaene from his office at the Cognitive Neuroimaging Unit at INSERM CEA in France.
So the goal of our study was to measure the brain activity in people who have not been to school and have not learned to read, and to compare it with people who have learned to read. So we wanted to measure the impact of literacy on brain activity, both in the visual system and also in the spoken language system. So the main question we had was whether literacy primarily improves brain function or whether it also entails losses, because after all, we've learned to read as a species only extremely recently. Reading was invented only about 5,000 years ago, and so there has not been time for humanity to evolve the specific reading system. We must be learning to read by reusing, or as I call it, recycling, some parts of the brain that evolve for other purposes.
So what population or populations of people did you and your team study to get at this question of how literacy affects brain responses or brain function?
So the study was conducted in France with people from Portugal that were flown to our institute in the south of Paris. We collaborated with Paolo Ventura and colleagues from Belgium, Regine Kolinsky and José Moraes. And it was also simultaneously conducted in Brazil, in Brasilia. We benefited from a strong collaboration with the Serra Hospitals, headed by Lucia Braga, where people from various levels of literacy were recruited from the neighborhood of Brasilia, sometimes from several kilometers from Brasilia.
And what did you and your colleagues have these study participants do?
So when they arrived, they took several behavioral tests to check their reading level and other competences. And then they took two brain imaging exams. We published actually only one of them in the paper, which is the functional magnetic resonance imaging exam, which allows us to look at brain activity. But we also have recordings of their event-related potentials, their electroencephalogram. So while they were in the fMRI scanner, they took several tests. One of them is what we call a localizer, which is a way to very quickly map areas involved in spoken and written language processing, as well as areas involved in calculation, motor commands, and some early visual processing. And then they took a specific test of vision involving mapping the areas that are involved in processing faces, places. We show them pictures of houses, pictures of tools, and, of course, strings of letters that were pronounceable, and also strings of characters that could have been in a foreign language but were completely invented. So we call them false fonts. And finally, we also had flashing checkers. So this was really a sort of mapping of the visual system organization.
Flashing checkers testing what?
Well, the flashing checkers served as a control for visual stimulation, but we were primarily interested in the category-specific responses of the brain to different categories of faces, houses, tools, and strings.
And this method, the functional magnetic resonance imaging, are these measurements now well established as a proxy for brain activity?
So the technique of functional magnetic resonance imaging, we are taking images of the whole brain several times per minute. In fact, we have one volume of the brain every 2 seconds. And what we can see is not directly neural activity, but is an indirect measurement, which would be pretty straightforwardly related to brain activity. So we literally see brain activation changes throughout the cortex, and we can ask for each voxel, does it respond preferentially to faces, to strings, to houses? We can sort of map out the selectivity of the organization of the cortex, and we do this at the level of several hundreds of thousands of voxels throughout the brain.
Any possibility that the study participants at these different literacy levels also had different abilities in comprehending what they were supposed to do, and that might perhaps skew the results in some way?
So there is, of course, the possibility that the subjects differed in other ways than just literacy. We did have a control for this in our study because part of the study involved listening to sentences and listening to commands in particular that ask the subjects to click the right button or the left button or to perform simple calculations such as calculate 7 minus 3. And when we look at just these images of spoken commands, whether it was motor commands or calculation commands, the activity was absolutely unchanged in all of the participants. So we take this as a reason to believe that they complied with our instructions very well, and that even the illiterates, although they, of course, were not very well accustomed to all of the technology that we deployed, were actually quite at ease in the machine and performing quite well. I should also say that we scanned three groups of people. Some people were completely illiterate in the sense that they had never been to school. They were not scholarized, and they could not read. They could identify only about half of the single letters that we showed them. Another group were people who had not been to school but had learned some reading later on in life, during adulthood. And so that comparison of what we call illiterate versus ex-illiterates, these adults who didn't go to school but learned to read later on, provides some measure of the pure effect of literacy, factoring out all of the other possible effects of schooling, which of course are very numerous. People learn at school all sorts of things beyond reading, such as arithmetic, but also social skills and so on.
So the effect of schooling, or rather learning to read as a child as compared to learning to read as an adult or later or outside of schooling, is what?
Our study did allow to ask whether it makes a difference to learn to read early as a child or late as an adult. Now, of course, the people who learned to read late as adults were not as skilled in reading as the people who had learned to read in childhood. But what we found was that if we compensate for that by matching subjects and regressing out the differences in reading score, all of the changes that we found due to literacy also existed in people who had learned to read as adults, so the ex-illiterates. And this was true for virtually all of the changes. So the main message of our study is that when you learn to read as adults, you may not reach the same final level of skill, and that might depend on the amount of training that you get. But for a given level of skill, you'll have the same sort of brain changes that you have if you learn to read as a child. There were only two exceptions to that. The one exception was the competition with faces. We found that there was no detectable competition for people who had learned to read as adults. So we cannot tell whether the competition simply does not exist because the visual system is a little bit more frozen, or whether this is due to the fact that they didn't get as expert as the normally literate schooled adults. The other change was in the prefrontal cortex, in the left hemisphere, in a region which we think may have to do with the gestures of writing, and which also gets activated when you read. And it's quite possible that the people who learn to read as adults do not make use of the gesture of writing, whereas, of course, when you learn as a child, you do just as much writing training as you do reading training.
Do your team's results then suggest that people who are especially literate are more lacking in reading faces then?
So our study allowed us to look at the prior function, as it were, of this area, which is going to become the visual word form area, before we learn to read. What we found is that if we look at this spot in people who have not yet learned to read, we found that this region responds strongly to faces and to checkerboards and to pictures of objects. Okay. Now we can ask, when you learn to read, do these responses change? Well, the answer is there is a little bit of change. There is a little bit of competition. So as you learn to read, the activation in this area to strings of letters increases. And at the same time, we find a little tiny decrease in the response to checkerboards and especially in the response to faces. So it seems to suggest that faces lose a little bit of cortical ground, specifically in this territory, which is going to become the visual waveform area, the brain's letterbox. Now, we made quite a few analyses of this particular point, and what we can show is that there is a small displacement of the responses to faces, but the peak responses are not affected. It's only at the fringe of the areas that respond to faces and to words that we find this competition. So it's a small effect, it's not massive, but I think it's theoretically important in supporting this recycling model when we learn a cultural function, such as reading, for which we did not evolve, we have to invade a specific place in cortex. We invade a region which is already caring about visual inputs and caring about invariant analysis of visual shapes, but this area will lose a little bit of its responsivity to other categories such as faces. It makes you wonder, of course, whether there are behavioral effects. So we are currently doing experiments to see if there are behavioral correlates, but not looking for an absolute decrease in performance, which I think is extremely unlikely, but rather looking for a small change in the manner in which faces might be processed, whether they are processed as a global whole or whether they are processed by parts. And we don't have the results yet, but we have to see in the future whether there will be such a change. I think I really want to emphasize that this is a small detectable effect at the brain level for which we don't have a behavioral equivalent at the moment.
Stanislas Dehan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Stanislas Dehan, director of the Cognitive Neuroimaging Unit at INSERM CEA, is lead author of a paper on how learning to read changes the brain's networks for vision and language. Find the paper online at scienceexpress.org.
The mood of the country has changed, specifically that to the extent people are pushing to reduce the deficit and cut the budget, scientists are worried that research will be caught up in that.
Scientist Jeffrey Mervis, along with fellow news writer Eli Kintish, report in this week's issue on how researchers are anxious and on the defensive after Republican gains in the latest U.S. election.
Traditionally, basic research has been supported by both parties, but the fear is that the acts won't distinguish between basic research and other functions of government.
Any projections as to whether these new members of Congress will find it easy to dismantle government programs, particularly science programs, that so many of which have had bipartisan support? Eli?
For a variety of reasons, mostly political ones, there hasn't been much wrangling between the budget committees that put together the yearly budget between the Senate and the House for the last 2 years. That might change, however, now, because now you have Republicans in control of the House, and they'll set their budget priorities, and Democrats clinging to control of the Senate, as well as the White House, which has veto power. And so we might see much more rancor on Capitol Hill over particular programs, and specifically scientific research.
Jeff, you have something to add?
In particular, there is support for increases in federal agencies such as the National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, Office of Science, NIST, and other programs. And what scientists are concerned is those promised increases won't come to pass. In other words, politicians will see the need to cut overall spending and not make exceptions for these research programs.
Is that likely one of the results of so many of these staunch supporters of science who've either lost their re-elections or retiring? Eli?
There's a combination in terms of the turnover on Capitol Hill. You do have some staunch supporters of science who are retiring, but more important is the fact that, as Jeff said, there's a mood, specifically with this movement of the Tea Party, which is really predicated on reducing the size of government, reducing the federal deficit. And so it may not be as much that there have lost pro-science people or that we're bringing on anti-science people per se, but simply that science may get caught up in a larger effort to reduce the size of the federal budget.
Jeff, you spoke with some of these retiring politicians. What would you say was their biggest message to scientists themselves?
I think their biggest message was that scientists have to do a better job connecting with the public. They have to do a better job explaining why their research is important and not just that it will contribute to our understanding of the world. They need to explain that it will eventually lead to new jobs. It will eventually lead to new industries. It will eventually improve the standard of living, improve health, improve national security. Not that any particular grant will do that in the short term, but they worry that scientists tend to be arrogant or tend to assume that their work is so important that if they just explain it to people, everyone will say, okay, sure, that's important to be supported. And their message was, you need to do a lot better than that, especially in the climate that we're in now.
Not only the political climate, but climate change itself. Eli, you read about that in this package of stories. It sounds as if the message that climate change itself, it hasn't necessarily even convinced lawmakers at this point.
You had a new phenomenon this election cycle, which was an unprecedented number of lawmakers vocally questioning the fundamental tenet of climate science of the last three decades, which is that human activities, greenhouse gases, are exacerbating or causing global warming. And we're not yet certain what the political effect of that new sort of groundswell of skepticism is going to be. The first effect was when Republicans took the House, President Obama basically declared his efforts to pass cap and trade legislation sort of dead at this point. He tried for 2 years. Now that so many either question the basic science on climate change or question cap and trade as a policy are now in power, Obama is looking for alternatives and new partners, essentially.
So there's not necessarily anything that can be done in the intervening time before the new Congress sits, this so-called lame duck session. There isn't major legislation that's ready to be voted on in the wings. Jeff?
Rob, there is a lot of legislation, but whether it's ready to be voted on is another matter, especially in the Senate, which has a long list of bills that the House has passed. The Senate is unlikely to do much on any of them, except they need to pass some form of budget for 2011. Whether that will be a continuing resolution, as it's called, which maintains funding at current levels, or an omnibus bill, which wraps a bunch of appropriation bills into one measure, is very important, as the lawmakers and our roundtable pointed out, because there are many increases proposed in 2011 that would not happen if a continuing resolution was passed. Increases for the new energy agency, ARPA-E, increases for the National Science Foundation, for the Office of Science at the Department of Energy, for NOAA, and other agencies. And so again, going back to this mood of let's freeze or cut the budget, there is a lot of concern that those proposed increases that the White House supports, that the House supports, that the Senate supports, will get lost in the rush to make sure that the budget is held flat.
What, if any, effect does this have internationally, the results of this election, on science around the world? Well, Jeff?
I think that one possible impact is where the U.S. stands on the global rankings of countries who are increasing research or cutting back on research. And I think you see quite a range in Asia, China, India, other countries are still supporting large, in some cases, double-digit increases. In other countries, the UK, as a prominent example, a recent government decision to freeze spending on education and research was greeted as a victory because there were fears of 20 and 30% cuts. So I think the question for the U.S. community is, where is the U.S. going to fit on that continuum? And then the world will take note of that and decide whether the U.S. is contributing to energy research that will solve climate change problems, contributing to other problems that the world is facing, or whether they're sitting on the sidelines.
Eli?
On climate policy, having declared the effort to set a cap and do a cap and trade system basically dead, Obama sends a kind of new signal overseas to China and India and other partners as to what the United States is able to do. And so the worst case scenario for some is that this will just lead to years of more deadlock in terms of global efforts to cut emissions. Optimists might say, well, maybe you could kind of have a piecemeal approach where different types of policies could lead to cuts. For example, the Montreal Protocol, which deals with mostly refrigerants, has actually led to the reduction of lots of greenhouse gas emissions, because a lot of refrigerants are greenhouse gas emissions. So there's a variety of other policies that the United States will have to now show the world they're pursuing, because the main weapon in the arsenal has been taken out.
Eli Kentish and Jeff Mervis, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
Science's Eli Kentish, along with fellow news writer Jeffrey Mervis, reported in this week's issue on how researchers are anxious and on the defensive after Republican gains in the latest U.S. election. To hear the roundtable Mervis mentioned, a discussion with five retiring legislators, go to our website, news.sciencemag.org, and click on Election 2010, where you can also read all of Science's special coverage. Whether at work, sweeping the floor, taking care of children, or really any activity, including having sex, new research suggests that focusing your mind on what you were doing is correlated with being happier. Now, previous studies have shown that mind wandering is essentially the default mode of operation, allowing us, no matter what we're doing, to contemplate past events, plan for the future, or even think creatively about things that don't exist.
In about 47% of samples, people said there was something other than what they were doing that they were thinking about.
Matt Killingsworth at Harvard University is co-author of a paper in this week's Science reporting that while mind wandering is common, a wandering mind is an unhappy one.
It was ubiquitous in the sense that the rate of mind wandering was greater than 30% in every activity other than sex. So this really seems to be something that not only happens often, but really pervades people's experience day to day.
Or at least among the people in Killingsworth's study. Thousands of Apple iPhone users who signed up to participate in a research project called trackyourhappiness.org that, according to the website, investigates what makes life worth living.
Certainly, you know, our sample isn't a random sample of all humans on Earth, and we would certainly make no claims that that's the case. But the kinds of relationships that we're seeing don't seem to have much relationship to things like people's income or other factors that might be biased in the people that we're looking at or in the way that we're studying them.
The application asks people via their smartphone at random times during the day to report how they are feeling, what they are doing, and whether they were thinking about something other than what they were doing. That last question could be answered in one of four ways. No, yes, mind wandering about something pleasant, yes, about something neutral, or yes, about something unpleasant. Again, study author Matt Killingsworth.
Not only were people less happy when they were mind wandering, they were less happy even when the topic of mind wandering itself was pleasant. Of course, it's very possible that people might just be mind wandering because they were unhappy to begin with. And so to try to begin to tease that apart, we conducted a time lag analysis. And what we found with that analysis was a strong relationship between mind wandering and future unhappiness, but no relationship between current unhappiness and future mind wandering, consistent with the idea that mind wandering itself seems to be causing unhappiness.
We've known that negative mood increases mind wandering.
Jonathan Schooler researches mind wandering and other types of what's called meta-awareness at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
If you induce negative mood in the laboratory, that leads to increased mind wandering, and depressed individuals tend to mind wander more. But this sort of ubiquitous finding that individuals tend to be less happy when their mind wandering is really groundbreaking.
But Schooler says that's not to suggest that people should avoid mind wandering, especially about positive things.
Those positive mind wandering episodes are very functional. They are the source of planning. They are the source of reflecting on positive life experiences. They are the opportunity for creativity and inventiveness. And I would be concerned if people took away from the study the sort of simplified conclusion that one should never mind wander, that mind wandering is necessarily a negative activity and that it would make you unhappy, necessarily.
In other words, says Schooler, it's important to be mindful about what you're mind wandering about.
to even defend the negative mind wandering, I mean, look, if you've got a difficult problem to solve, it may be painful to think about it as you try to work through what are the assortment of options, none of which are really ideal, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, right? It may lead to ultimately improved mood as you come up with a useful solution. So I think it's important to not even necessarily say that all mind wandering that leads to negative mood is necessarily unadvisable, because there are useful functions that even it can serve.
What's key, say both Schooler and study author Matt Killingsworth, is that in terms of your happiness, what you do is separate from what you think about. Study author Matt Killingsworth explains.
If you want to be happy, you might make some progress by choosing activities that you enjoy, but when you leave the present, when your mind strays from those activities, there's no guarantee that just because you're happy to begin with, you're any more likely to, you know, avoid the worries and rumination and other kinds of things that might come along with that.
You can find Killingsworth's paper, A Wandering Mind is an Unhappy Mind, in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how whales get sunburns, too. Is this a new phenomenon, Dave?
Well, that's what researchers are trying to find out. Rob, over the past few years, marine biologists have noticed skin lesions on whales and dolphins and other cetaceans. And usually these lesions are the result of an infection, like a fungal infection. But one researcher wondered whether there might be something more going on. The lesions reminded her a little bit of what skin cancer looks like in people, and she was curious whether whales were getting sunburned and potentially skin cancer just like people do.
Were there prior studies to serve as controls here?
Well, Rob, there wasn't a control group per se, but the study was conducted over a three-year period. And what the researchers saw was that they noticed a lot more of these, what they call blisters, the number of blue whales especially, which have light skin, just like, you know, humans can have light skin, whales have different skin color, and fairer humans tend to get more sunburns and sun cancer. Well, it turns out that blue whales, which are the fairest of the three whales the researchers studied, they studied blue whales, fin whales, which have dark skin, and sperm whales, which are sort of in the middle in terms of skin color.
And this increase is indicative of what?
Well, the researchers think that it has to do with a thin ozone layer. The ozone layer is a lot thinner than it used to be a few decades ago, and that's increased the amount of UV radiation that shines down on Earth. And that's why you and I, when it gets really bright outside, will reach for a t-shirt if we don't have a top on, or reach for that bottle of suntan lotion. Well, whales don't have that luxury. In the past, it may not have been as big of a problem because the UV radiation wasn't as high as it is now. But now you're talking about these creatures that have very large body sizes, spend a lot of time at the surface, and even when they're not at the surface, they're maybe just a few meters below the water, and even then they're still receiving the UV radiation. So there's a lot of concern that these creatures that are spending a lot of their lives in the sun are putting themselves at risk for sunburns and, more problematically, skin cancer.
Did researchers find any examples of skin cancer?
Well, they didn't find any examples of skin cancer. And the way they actually studied these whales is they took photographs, one, but they also shot darts into the whales. And this was harmless, but they were able to shoot these darts into the whales, pull the darts back, and the darts had these little skin samples. And researchers would do a biopsy of the skin samples, just like you would do if you went to your dermatologist and he or she took out a hunk of your skin and looked at it. Well, these biologists took a look at these small chunks of whale skin, and they noticed a lot of things that they see in humans with skin damage, things like an increased production of microvesicles, the vesicles that are present in skin, an increase in the particles in skin cells that help repair damaged tissue, and more melanin. And melanin is what increases in our skin when we get tan, but it's also a sign that we're being overexposed to the sun. So they're seeing a lot of this evidence that the whale skin is becoming damaged by sun, but so far no evidence of skin cancer.
So another indication then of ozone depletion here, it sounds like.
That's what the researchers are speculating. They don't have solid evidence that this increase in skin damage is actually linked to ozone, but the timing seems about right. And what experts say is really important about the study is that researchers now have a tool to study skin cancer in whales, and now they have a data set that they can compare it to, so they can look over the next few years whether they're seeing more and more of these lesions in whales and whether any of these lesions are developing into cancer.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from our sun to the billions of suns out there in the universe, this next story is about giant balls of hundreds of thousands of tightly spaced stars known as globular clusters and how they formed.
Don't researchers already have hypotheses about how that happened?
Well, they do, and they've turned to one of their favorite culprits in the universe, which is dark matter. And Rob, dark matter is this mysterious, invisible substance that permeates the entire universe and is actually thought to make up most of the known universe, although we can't actually see it. And researchers have used dark matter to explain a variety of phenomena, like the shape of spiral galaxies, for example. And so in this case, researchers said, well, you've got this really tightly clumped ball of stars. And the thing about globular clusters is these stars are ancient. These are some of the first stars thought to have formed in the universe. So the question is, how did these stars clump together in the first place when you had this early universe where there wasn't a lot of things around? And the popular going theory is that there was a lot of dark matter around, and dark matter formed these halos that compressed gas and dust in the early universe, sparking star formation, and then the dark matter would have stuck around, keeping these stars sort of clumped together in these balls of thousands of stars.
And what are researchers saying now?
Well, researchers are saying, where's the dark matter? They looked at two of these globular clusters, one called NGC 2419, which is about 30,000 light years from the center of the Milky Way. Another one called MGC1, which is located about 65,000 light years from the center of the nearby Andromeda Galaxy. And the reason they chose clusters so far out from the galactic centers is because they wanted to look at a cluster that looked like it did when the universe first began. And when you have these clusters that are far away from the galactic center, they're not as exposed to as many violent conditions. So if there was dark matter around billions of years ago, it should still be there. It shouldn't have been pulled away by, you know, some sort of bizarre activity happening closer to the galactic center. So these are what the researchers say are pristine globular clusters. They've really been untouched over time. But when they looked at these guys, they didn't see any evidence for dark matter. The idea is if there is dark matter holding these clusters together, holding these stars together in the cluster, then the cluster should be really tightly packed. But what the researchers saw is that the edges of these clusters, there were stars missing, as if they had sort of drifted away. And you wouldn't expect that if there was dark matter or a dark matter halo still there. So they conclude based on this that there was never any dark matter in the first place, because if it was there, if it used to be there, it should still be there, because these are pristine globular clusters.
Is this prompting researchers, astronomers, cosmologists to reconsider dark matter's role or even dark matter's existence in how these various structures like spiral galaxies come to look the way they do?
Well, the researchers don't go that far. They say just because we don't see dark matter here doesn't mean it's not anywhere. But what they do say is that we may have to rethink how at least globular clusters form, and we should look at a lot more of these clusters to find evidence of dark matter. So far, nobody's found any evidence of dark matter with the clusters that they've looked at. And so these studies seem to be poking holes in this theory that dark matter is really required for these clusters to form. But if that is the case, then you're right, Rob, then it could be that dark matter may not be important for a lot of the things that we thought in the universe. Although, again, the researchers aren't quite willing to go that far just on the basis of studying two globular clusters out of the probably thousands or millions or even billions of these clusters that are out there.
Okay. So last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from how globular clusters evolved to how insects evolved, this last story is about how the insect brain has changed over time.
So looking at old ones trapped in amber or something like that?
Actually, no. What researchers did in this study was they looked at insects that resemble insects that lived millions of years ago. What they're basically trying to figure out is this whole idea of why social insects have such large brains. And it's not just that their brains are big, but they have these structures in them called mushroom bodies. And these are these mushroom-shaped, as you might expect, brain regions that are really important for processing and remembering smells and sights. Now, when I say social insects, we're talking about insects like ants and bees, insects that live in these really large, complex societies where there's caste system and a lot of really intricate relationships with all the members. Researchers have long thought, okay, we're seeing these mushroom bodies in these social insects, and we've linked these mushroom bodies to sort of higher intelligence or at least higher cognitive processing. These insects must have evolved these mushroom bodies because they live in these really complex societies and they need a lot of brain processing power to deal with these societies. So that was the going hypothesis.
So there are examples of precursors of social insects that are around today?
Basically, the researchers in this study looked at wasps. And the idea with the evolution of an insect like a wasp is that the earliest wasps were probably plant eaters. And then over evolutionary time, some of them branched off and began becoming parasitic. They would lay their eggs in the larvae of other insects. And then even further along or more recently in evolutionary history, some of these parasitic insects would have branched off and would have become social insects, the type of wasps that live in these very complicated social colonies. And the neat thing is that even though this evolution has taken place over tens of millions of years, there still are around today wasps that only eat plants and wasps that are parasitic. So even though these aren't the exact same creatures that were around, say, 50 million, 100 million years ago, they have the same sort of lifestyle. So the idea is if we can look at them, we can study what the brains were like in these creatures that existed before social wasps came on the scene.
What were the brains like?
So what the researchers did was they compared the brains of plant-eating wasps to parasitic wasps, the wasps that lay their eggs in the larvae of other insects. And what they found was that the parasitic wasps had larger and more elaborate mushroom bodies than the non-parasites. In particular, the caps of these mushroom bodies were about twice the size in the parasitic wasps than in the plant-eating or the non-parasitic wasps. And this really throws a wrench into the theory that it was this transition from parasitism to being social that created these really large mushroom bodies. It looks like these mushroom bodies were already in place when at least these wasps were still engaged in a parasitic lifestyle.
In place, or was there further evolution when these insects became social?
Well, that's still an open question. It's possible that just because these parasitic insects had bigger mushroom bodies, the mushroom bodies could have gotten even bigger or maybe even more specialized and complex when the wasps became social, and that's going to require further study. But the bottom line conclusion here is that this idea that the insects could only become social once they developed these mushroom bodies seems wrong. It looks like they already had these mushroom bodies, so that may have been the big evolutionary leap from non-parasitism to parasitism versus from parasitism to social lifestyle.
Are there analogs in other species?
Well, dolphins also have very large and complicated brains, and they also have very complicated societies. And a lot of other mammals with large brains also live in these highly social societies. And so researchers see analogs between mammals and these insects. Now, whether this study in particular will translate into how we view mammalian brain evolution, probably not. There's too much difference between insects and mammals, but it just does cause us to rethink some of our hypotheses about how brains evolved, at least in this case, how insect brains evolved.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about the creature with the largest testicles on Earth, at least compared to its body size, and also a story about how cats lap up water. It turns out there's a lot of tricky physics involved. And on Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about how scientists want to count every single species on Earth. And also a story about Chinese science. Two prominent Chinese scientists have claimed that Chinese research is corrupt, and China's government has responded to this. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the November 12th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.